Okay, let's set a scene. You have a 68-year-old client, post-op. He's weak, the cardiac monitor keeps alarming, and his morning labs just hit the chart. Potassium K plus is 5.8.
Oof, that's high.
Yeah, and you notice he has some muscle weakness, a little diarrhea.
Yeah.
So what is your absolute non-negotiable first priority action?
That right there, that is a classic high-stakes NCLEX question. And it's exactly what this deep dive is all about. We aren't just, you know, memorizing facts today. We're building that clinical judgment muscle you need to pick the one right answer when things are going sideways.
Welcome to ConceptCast, your high-yield audio mentor, brought to you by Nursing Notes. If you're prepping for the NCLEX, you know it's a test of safety, judgment, and priorities. So today, we are locking down the absolute foundation.
Mm-hmm. The areas where mistakes are the most dangerous, and, well, because of that, they're the most heavily tested. We're talking fluid and electrolytes, acid-base balance, essential med safety.
And those super tricky legal and ethical delegation scenarios. Our mission here is to give you the blueprint, the mental shortcuts, to confidently pick the right action every single time.
So let's circle back to that first scenario. K plus at 5.8, the alarms, the weakness. The answer, and this needs to be instinct, is immediate cardiac monitoring and assessment.
Why that first?
Because high potassium is a direct life-threatening threat to the heart's electrical system. It can and will cause lethal dysrhythmias if you don't intervene. Everything else can, wait a minute, the heart can't. Okay, so that's our benchmark for today. We're not just defining concepts, we're digging into the why behind the priority. So let's unpack it starting right there with the chemistry of prioritization, fluid and electrolyte imbalances. To really get a handle on things like edema or dehydration, we have to start with the basic physics of how fluid moves around the body. It sounds like boring science, but I promise you the NCLEX uses these principles to test your assessment skills constantly.
Absolutely. Let's do a super quick review of the three big concepts. First up, diffusion.
Diffusion is pretty simple. It's just the movement of solutes, you know, molecules like salt or sugar, from an area where there's a lot of them to an area where there's less.
It's just things spreading out to find a balance.
Exactly. Spreading out to equilibrium. No extra energy needed. Mm. Passive movement.
Okay, so number two is filtration. This one's a little different.
Yeah, filtration involves pressure. It's the movement of both fluid and solutes across a membrane because of a pressure gradient. The big one to know is hydrostatic pressure.
Which is basically the pressure from the heart pumping, right? Pushing blood out into the capillaries.
That's it. It's that push pressure forcing fluid out of the blood vessels and into the space around the cells.
Okay, so that brings us to the third concept, and this one feels like it's on every test. The role of albumin.
Mm-hmm. This is huge. Albumin is a protein your liver makes, and it is the main driver of what we call plasma colloid osmotic pressure. You'll also hear it called oncotic pressure.
Okay, so if hydrostatic pressure is the push force, what's oncotic pressure?
It's the pull force. I like to think of albumin as a tiny little water magnet or a sponge floating in your blood vessels. Its job is to pull fluid back into the capillaries from that interstitial space.
So it keeps the fluid where it's supposed to be in circulation.
Exactly. And here is the high yield point the NCLEX loves to target. What happens if a client has low serum albumin?
Well, if the little water magnets aren't there, the pulling force would be weaker.
Right. The oncotic pressure drops. This happens in clients with severe malnutrition, major burns, or, the classic example, liver failure. Because the liver can't produce the albumin.
So you've got that hydrostatic pressure still pushing fluid out, but not enough oncotic pressure to pull it back in.
And where does the fluid go? It gets stuck. It stays in that interstitial space, and that leads to significant edema. In really severe cases, it's called anasarca, which is just massive generalized swelling.
So if you see a test question that links liver disease or low protein with pitting edema, your brain has to immediately connect that to low albumin and low oncotic pressure.
And your nursing intervention isn't just about watching the swelling. It's about monitoring their nutrition, their liver function, and assessing for fluid overload if they get an albumin infusion. Okay, great foundation. Now let's pivot back to the electrolyte that started all this. Potassium. K plus, yes. The normal range is so narrow, 3.5 to 5.0, precisely because it's such a powerful regulator of electrical signals in the body, especially the heart.
Let's start on the high side. Hyperkalemia. So anything over 5.0.
As we said, the number one system at risk is the heart. The muscle cells get irritable, they get twitchy, they're ready to fire off on their own. And that leads to those life-threatening dysrhythmias. High K plus equals cardiac irritability, period.
And what are the big causes the NCLEX wants us to know? The number one cause they test is end-stage renal disease, ESRD. It's simple. The kidneys are supposed to get rid of potassium and they just can't anymore. Okay, so kidney failure. What else?
You might see it with massive tissue injury, like a crush injury or severe burns where potassium leaks out of all the damaged cells. Also, some potassium-sparing diuretics can do it.
And what's the classic picture? The signs and symptoms they'll put in the question stem?
The hot list for the exam is 1, generalized muscle weakness, often starting in the legs. 2, GI hyperactivity, so diarrhea. And 3, the absolute most critical are the EKG changes.
Which are?
Tall, peaked T waves. It's the hallmark sign on a monitor that tells you the cardiac muscle is dangerously irritable.
So we've established the priority is slapping on that cardiac monitor. But what's next? How do we actually treat this?
Well, you have to think about two things.
The quick fix and the permanent removal. They're not the same.
Okay, yeah.
What's the quick fix?
The fast fix is to shift the potassium out of the blood and back into the cells where it's less dangerous. We do that by giving a combination of regular insulin and 10% dextrose, or D5W.
And how does that work?
The insulin acts like a key that unlocks the cell door and forces potassium to go inside. It's a very rapid but temporary solution to stabilize the heart.
And why the dextrose? That feels like a key nursing judgment point.
It absolutely is. You give the dextrose with the insulin to prevent the patient from becoming hypoglycemic. The insulin is going to drop their blood sugar, so you give them sugar at the same time to counteract that.
Got it. So that's the temporary fix. What about getting it out of the body for good?
For permanent removal, you have a couple options. One is a drug called chiaxylate. It's a resin that binds with potassium in the gut and gets excreted in the stool. Or, for the most severe, life-threatening cases, the ultimate removal method is dialysis.
So it's critical to know the difference between the acute, shifting interventions, and the long-term removal strategies.
Yep. Yes, and Clex will test that difference.
Okay, let's flip to the other side. Hypokalemia. Potassium less than 3.5. If hyperkalemia makes things irritable, what does hypokalemia do?
It makes things sluggish, flaccid, weak.
And what causes this? Where does all the potassium go?
Think aggressive fluid loss. Potent diuretics, especially loop diuretics like furosemide. Also, prolonged severe diarrhea or a lot of GI suctioning, like with an NG tube. You are literally sucking or flushing the potassium out of the body.
And the clinical picture, what does the patient look like?
You'll see progressive muscle weakness. It can get so bad it leads to flaccid paralysis and even affects the respiratory muscles. And critically, the GI tract slows way down. You get abdominal distension.
Why the distension?
It's because the muscles of the intestine have become flaccid and weak. They can't perform peristalsis effectively, which puts the client at a huge risk for a paralytic ileus.
And the EKG? Is it just the opposite of hyperkalemia?
It is. Instead of those tall, peaked T waves, you see a flattened or low T wave and a depressed ST segment. It's a sign of decreased cardiac electrical activity.
Okay, one last critical safety point for treating hypokalemia.
Yes, this is a huge one. You never, ever give IV potassium as a push or a bolus, ever. It has to be diluted and it has to be infused slowly, usually over at least an hour.
Why is that?
Two reasons. One, it's extremely irritating to the veins. And two, and more importantly, a rapid push of potassium will cause immediate fatal cardiac arrest.
Got it. Slow and diluted. Okay, let's shift gears to sodium, Na+.
Sodium is all about water balance. Where sodium goes, water follows. So when you think of sodium imbalances, I want you to immediately think neurological symptoms. Normal range is about 135 to 145.
Let's start with the high side again. Hypernatremia. Sodium over 145.
When you see high sodium, you should really be thinking dehydration. There's too little water for the amount of sodium in the blood.
What causes that? Just not drinking enough water?
That's a big one, yeah. Water deprivation. Also, excessive insensible losses, like from a high fever or hyperventilation. And then there are conditions like diabetes insipidus.
So what's happening inside the body?
The high concentration of sodium in the blood literally pulls water out of the body cells, causing them to shrink and shrivel up. And when this happens to brain cells, you get neurological symptoms.
Of what?
It starts with restlessness, agitation, confusion, but it can progress to seizures or even a coma.
And the treatment is just give them water.
Essentially, yes. We're restoring the water deficit, usually with hypotonic fluids like 0.45% saline or maybe D5W. But, and this is a massive safety point, you have to do it slowly.
Why slowly? It seems like you'd want to fix it fast.
Because if you correct it too quickly, water will rush back into those shriveled brain cells, causing them to swell, and that leads to cerebral edema, which can be just as deadly. You have to bring them back to normal, cautiously.
Slow and steady. Okay, so now hyponatremia. sodium less than 135.
This is usually the opposite problem. It's often dilutional, meaning you have too much water for the amount of sodium.
What would cause that?
Potent diuretics can do it,
right.
Certain endocrine disorders, or a classic scenario is someone who sweats a ton, like a marathon runner, and then rehydrates with just massive amounts of plain water. They've diluted all their sodium.
And what's happening to the cells now?
Now the blood is too dilute, so water rushes into the cells, causing them to swell. And since your skull is a fixed box, brain cell swelling is catastrophic.
So you're looking for neurological signs again.
Absolutely. Abdominal cramps are common, but the big scary ones are seizures and a severely altered mental status.
And treatment here. Is it just getting rid of the extra water?
Yeah, often we start with just a fluid restriction. And in very severe cases, we might give a small amount of hypertonic saline, like 3% ACL. But again,
slowly.
Yeah.
Very slowly. Correcting hyponatremia too fast has its own specific named complication.
Yeah.
Central pontine myelinolysis, or CPM. It causes severe, often irreversible neurological damage. So the big takeaway for sodium is it's all about the brain. And any correction, high or low, must be done slowly and carefully.
You got it. That's the key. Okay, let's move on to the next major area of internal chemistry, acid-base balance.
Right.
This is where a lot of people's eyes glaze over, but if you can just memorize your normal values and understand a simple mnemonic, you can crush any ABG question they throw at you.
Okay, let's anchor ourselves with those normal values first. What are they?
First is pH, which measures acidity. Normal is 7.35 to 7.45. Then you have PCO2, which is your respiratory component. Normal is 35 to 45.
And notice how that's backward. A low PCO2 is alkalotic, a high one is acidic.
Exactly. And the third player is HCO3, or bicarbonate, which is your metabolic component. Normal there is 22 to 26.
And the mnemonic is ROME, respiratory opposite, metabolic equal.
Let's walk through it. Let's start with metabolic acidosis. So a pH less than 7.35 and an HCO3 less than 22. The body has too much acid or has lost too much base.
And what's the classic NCLEX cause for this?
Diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. In DKA, because there's no insulin, the body starts breaking down fat for energy, which produces a ton of acidic byproducts called ketones. This just floods the system with acid and tanks the pH.
So how does the body fight back?
The body's fastest defense is the lungs. It tries to compensate by blowing off CO2 because CO2 forms carbonic acid in the blood. So to get rid of acid, you get rid of CO2.
And how does it do that?
It starts breathing very deep and very fast. This specific breathing pattern has a name, and you have to know it. It's called Kussmaul breathing.
Kussmaul breathing. So if you see that in a question stem with a diabetic client, your brain should be screaming metabolic acidosis.
100%. And you know the priority isn't to make them stop breathing fast. The priority is to fix the underlying DKA with insulin and fluids. Okay, next up, respiratory alkalosis. So here, the pH is high above 7.45, and the PCO2 is low, below 35. We have too little acid because we're breathing out too much CO2.
And the causes seem pretty straightforward for this one.
Yeah, the number one cause is hyperventilation, either from an anxiety or panic attack, or, and this is a big test point, because the settings on their mechanical ventilator are too aggressive. They're being overventilated.
And what does that look like? The symptoms?
Rapid breathing, feeling dizzy or lightheaded, and often a tingling or a numbness around the mouth or in the fingers and toes.
And the nursing action is all about fixing the cause.
Exactly. If they're anxious, you coach them to slow their breathing, maybe breathe into a paper bag to rebreathe some of that CO2. If they're on a vent, you have to call the provider immediately because those settings need to be changed.
Got it. Let's finish the set with metabolic alkalosis.
So high pH above 7.45 and a high bicarb above 26. Too much base or not enough acid.
And the key cause here for the NCLEX.
Loss of acid from the stomach. Think prolonged severe vomiting or, even more commonly tested, a patient with an NG tube set to continuous gastric suction. You are literally sucking out all their hydrochloric acid.
And the symptoms. If acidosis causes Kussmaul breathing, what does alkalosis do?
Well, the body tries to compensate by holding on to acid. And the way it does that is by slowing down breathing to retain CO2. So you see slow, shallow respirations.
So what about the muscles?
Because the system is too basic, the CNS and muscles get overexcited. You can see muscle hypertonicity, tremors, and even tetany.
Okay, let's do a quick practice run. Walk me through interpreting an ABG.
Okay.
Let's say the pH is 7.25, PCO2 is 35, and HCO3 is 20.
Okay, perfect. Step one, always look at the pH. 7.25 is low, so we know it's acidosis.
Okay, acidosis. Step two.
Look at the PCO2. It's 35, which is right on the low end of normal, so it's probably not a respiratory problem.
So now we look at the bicarb, the HCO3. It's 20, which is low, below 22.
Right. And remember, Rome metabolic equal. The pH is low, acidosis, and the bicarb is low. They're going in the same direction, so it's metabolic.
So it's metabolic acidosis, and since the PCO2 is still in the normal range, there's no compensation yet.
Perfect. Uncompensated metabolic acidosis. If you follow that three-step process every single time, you won't get tricked. Excellent. All right. Let's shift from body chemistry to one of the most tested areas on the entire exam, medication administration and high-risk pharmacology.
Yeah, this is so much more than just reading a label. This is where clinical judgment, patient safety, and legal accountability all collide. And we have to start by going beyond the traditional five rights of med admin, right? Everyone knows the original five, right? Mm-hmm. Client, right med, right dose, right rep, right time. But that's just the starting line. The modern standard is the 10 rights, and the additional five are what really cover your legal and safety bases.
Okay, what?
Right, client education. They have to know what they're taking and why. Right documentation. The right to refuse care. Right client assessment, like checking a blood pressure before you give an antihypertensive.
And the last one.
Right evaluation. Did the pain med actually work? Did the antibiotic cause a reaction? If you skip these last five, you are walking into a negligence trap.
We also have to talk about documentation safety, specifically the do not use list of abbreviations from the Joint Commission.
Oh, this is huge. So many errors happen because of sloppy abbreviations. You have to write out every day. You have to write units. You can't use CC for milliliters anymore. And you absolutely cannot use MS or MSO4.
Because it could mean morphine sulfate or magnesium sulfate. Two very different, very dangerous drugs to mix up.
Exactly. And then there are the zeros. This is so simple, but so critical.
Always use a leading zero before a decimal. So write 0.5 LML, not just 0.5 mil.
Right, because if that little dot gets missed, 0.5 suddenly looks like 5, and you've just created a tenfold overdose.
And the opposite is also true. Never use a trailing zero. Write 5 milligrams, not 5.0 milligrams.
Because if that decimal point gets missed, 5.0 can be misread as 50. These aren't suggestions. They are mandatory safety rules.
Okay, let's drill down into three drug classes that are high risk and therefore high priority for testing. Let's start with opioid analgesics, morphine, fentanyl. The mechanism is clear. They bind to opiate receptors in the CNS and block the perception of pain. But the number one top priority nursing assessment is respiratory depression. Why?
Because opioids suppress the brainstem's drive to breathe. The core nursing care is just relentless monitoring of their respiratory rate and their depth, especially in that first hour after giving a dose.
And what do you need to have at the bedside, just in case?
You must have the reversal agent, naloxone, immediately available. That is a legal and safety standard of care.
Okay, besides breathing, what are the other big side effects to know?
Constipation. It's almost guaranteed because opioids slow down GI motility. You should always be proactive about giving stool softeners. Also, orthostatic hypotension, which is a fall risk. And of course, the legal side accurate counts of all controlled substances and having a witness when you waste any unused portion.
Hmm.
Okay, next high risk class. NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, your ibuprofens, naproxens. These are great for pain and inflammation, but they come with a huge risk. They work by blocking things called prostaglandins.
And what do prostaglandins do?
Well, they cause pain and inflammation, which is why blocking them works. But they also produce the protective mucus lining of your stomach. So when you block them, you leave the stomach vulnerable to acid.
And that leads to the major side effect, GI ulceration and bleeding. So all our nursing care is focused on protecting the stomach and watching for bleeding.
Exactly. You teach the client to always take NSAIDs with food or milk to buffer that irritation. And you teach them to watch for signs of a GI bleed, specifically black, tarry stools, which we call melena. Okay, and our third massive topic, antibiotics. Let's hit three key concepts here. First, timing. To keep the drug level in the blood stable and effective at killing bacteria, antibiotics have to be given at equal intervals around the clock. If a drug is ordered every 12 hours, that means 9 a.m. and 9 p.m., not just whenever it's convenient during the day shift.
Client teaching.
You must counsel clients to complete the full prescribed course, even if they start feeling better after a couple of days. Stopping early is how we create superbugs like MRSA.
Okay, and third, let's talk about specific toxicities for some high-risk antibiotics. Let's start with the tetracyclines.
Tetracyclines are unique because they bind to calcium. This means they're absolutely contraindicated in children younger than 8 and in the second half of pregnancy because they will permanently stain developing teeth and can affect bone growth. Also, you have to teach clients not to take them with dairy products, antacids, or iron supplements, because the calcium in those products will bind to the drug and make it useless.
Okay, next up, the amyloglycosides, like gentamicin. These have a famous dual toxicity.
They do, and it's a mandatory test point. They are ototoxic, meaning they can damage hearing and balance, and they are nephrotoxic, meaning they can damage the kidneys.
So nursing care is all about monitoring those two systems.
All about it. You're watching their renal function labs like BUN and creatinine, and you're doing frequent hearing and balance assessments.
And lastly, vancomycin.
Vanc is tricky. The big thing to know is that it has a very narrow therapeutic index.
What does that mean?
It means the difference between a dose that works and a dose that's toxic is very, very small. It's like walking a tightrope. So because of that, we have to monitor peak and trough blood levels.
Explain peak and trough.
The trough level is drawn right before you hang the next dose to make sure the drug level hasn't fallen too low to be effective. The peak level is drawn after the infusion is done to make sure it hasn't gone so high that it becomes toxic to the kidneys and ears.
Okay, this final section might be the most critical for the NCLEX because it's not just about what you know, it's about how you manage a team safely and legally. We're talking delegation and accountability.
Yes.
And the first ironclad rule is this. The registered nurse, the RN, always retains accountability for the outcome of a delegated task. Always. So you can give away the responsibility for doing the task, but something goes wrong, it's still on you, the RN.
It's still on you, which is why you have to follow the five rights of delegation. This isn't just a list to memorize, it's a decision-making tool.
What are they?
Right task, right situation, right person, right direction and communication, and right supervision and evaluation. If you violate any one of those, you're making an unsafe delegation.
Okay, let's talk about the specific roles. The NCLEX loves to test the boundaries between the RN, the LPN, and the UAP. Let's start at the top with the RN.
The RN handles anything that requires advanced knowledge or is unstable. That means the initial comprehensive assessment, all patient teaching, complex evaluation, and developing the plan of care, and only RNs can delegate.
Okay, what about the LPN or LVN?
LPNs work with stable patients. They can do many routine procedures like dressing changes, urinary catheterization, and they can give most routine meds oral, IM, sub-Q. But they cannot do that initial comprehensive assessment on a new patient.
And finally, the UAP, or unlicensed assistive personnel.
The UAP is all about routine, non-invasive tasks related to activities of daily living, bathing, feeding, ambulating, and getting routine measurements like vital signs, intake and output, height and weight.
Okay, so let's talk about the big trap here, the evaluation trap.
Yes, this is a favorite NCLEX question style. A UAP can obtain a blood pressure reading, that's a measurement, a piece of data. They are allowed to do that. But if that blood pressure is on a patient who just got their very first dose of a new antihypertensive drug, only the RN can evaluate the patient's response to that medication. The UAP can't interpret the meaning of that number in the context of the new drug. That requires RN-level knowledge and judgment.
That's a fantastic distinction. Okay, let's shift to client rights and informed consent.
The key word is informed. The client has to understand the procedure, the risks, and the alternatives. And it is the provider's job, the doctor or NP, to give that explanation.
So what is the nurse's role then? The nurse's role is to witness the signature and, more importantly, to ensure the client actually understands and is giving consent voluntarily. So here's the test point. If you walk in with a consent form, the client says, you know, I don't really get what the recovery is like for this. What do? You stop. You don't try to explain it yourself. You call the provider to come back and clarify.
Exactly. You are witnessing their understanding, not giving the explanation.
What about the right to refuse treatment?
A competent adult can refuse anything, even if it's life-saving. Where it gets tricky is with an unconscious client. If a family member tries to refuse a blood transfusion for religious reasons, the nurse can't just accept that. You have to notify the provider immediately because a spouse often doesn't have the legal power to make that choice without a specific legal document, like a healthcare power of attorney.
Okay, let's quickly nail down some legal terms. Torts. What is negligence?
Negligence is just the failure to act as a reasonably prudent nurse would in the same situation. And that failure results in harm to the patient.
Give me an example.
Leaving a stretcher with a broken, worn-out safety strap available for use, a reasonably prudent nurse would have recognized that danger and taken it out of service. Another big one is failing to question a doctor's order that is clearly unsafe. You are the last line of defense.
Okay, and what's the difference between assault and battery?
This is simple. Assault is the threat of unwanted touching. If you say to a patient, if you don't cooperate, I'm going to tie you down, that's assault.
And battery is?
Battery is the actual unlawful touching. Physically restraining someone without a proper order or doing a procedure without consent, that's battery.
Okay, time for our rapid fire check. Let's lock these concepts in. Question one.
What are two critical findings in severe hypokalemia related to muscle function? One cardiac and one GI. Take a second to think.
The answer is a depressed T wave on the EKG for the cardiac finding and flaccidity of the intestinal muscles causing abdominal distension for the GI finding.
Perfect. Question two on pharmacology. To prevent kidney damage when giving sulfonamide antibiotics, what nursing intervention is the top priority?
Promote increased fluid intake. You have to hydrate the patient to prevent the drug from forming crystals in the urine, which protects the kidneys.
Okay, question three on delegation. An LPN reports to you that a stable client's urine output is 20 LINL-HR. The LPN says, I think the client is dehydrated. What is the RN's priority action regarding the LPN's report?
The RN must take over the evaluation. The LPN correctly gathered the data, the 20 millidel an hour, but making the clinical judgment that the client is dehydrated is an evaluation, and that is an RN's job. That's the evaluation trap again.
Excellent. Last one, acid base. A client on a ventilator has tingling in their hands, they feel lightheaded, and their ABG shows a pH of 7.55 and a PCO2 of 28. What is the cause, and what is the nurse's first action?
The cause is respiratory alkalosis from being overventilated. The priority action is to notify the provider immediately so the ventilator settings can be adjusted to slow down their breathing and retain some CO2.
Nailed it. We've covered a ton of ground, so let's distill this down to the four non-negotiable concepts you absolutely have to take with you into the NCLEX. Okay, number one, know your toxicities. You have to have these memorized. Opioids threaten the respiratory system. Monitor their breathing. Aminoglycosides and vancomycin threaten the ears and kidneys. Monitor labs and function. NSAIDs threaten the GI system. Give with food. Watch for bleeding. Takeaway number two, prioritize the cardiac and airway above all else. In any fluid and electrolyte emergency or with any high-risk drug, your first thought is always ABC's airway, breathing, circulation. For potassium problems, it's all about circulation. Get that cardiac monitor on immediately.
Delegation is accountability for assessment and evaluation. You can delegate tasks, like getting vitals to a UAP or doing a stable dressing change to an LPN. But anything that requires initial assessment, patient teaching, or complex evaluation of a patient's response, that belongs to the RN, period. And number four, master ABG interpretation with ROAM. Know your normal values cold. Understand that Kussmaul breathing is the body's attempt to fix metabolic acidosis. Use the ROAM mnemonic respiratory opposite, metabolic equal to comorbid, diagnose the primary problem every single time.
All right. If your head is spinning a little bit from all that high-yield information, I promise you that is completely normal. Mastering these concepts takes repetition. It's tough. But every single time you work through one of these prioritization questions, you're getting one step closer to being that safe, prudent nurse.
We know that repetition is absolutely the key to passing the NCLEX. It's how you make these concepts stick so they're second nature when you're under pressure. And that's really why we built nursing notes the way we did.
Yeah, we use something called music-powered learning. We are actually first and only resource that uses original music to help you lock these high-yield ideas into your long-term memory. It makes memorizing all this complex information way more efficient.
And our AI tools are specifically designed to reinforce the exact concepts we covered today, quizzing you and helping you build that critical thinking muscle until it becomes automatic.
We were built by nurses who have been right where you are now, staring down this massive exam. So stay dedicated, keep practicing your prioritization, stay confident, and we will catch you on the next deep dive. You've got this.